Welcome, this is William Ebbins and we're shifting gears. This is the third in a series of conversations with Richard Manning, a journalist living in Helena, Montana. Welcome again, Richard.
Thanks, Will. Good to be here.
We talked last time about some of the abuse of children and the impact of that on the nervous system, particularly the internal autonomic nervous system, and the lack of developing identity and also the ability to make life-sustaining choices, so we can get trapped in a situation of fear and unnecessary greed and violence.
Yeah. It's interesting in that a history, and we think we're talking about child abuse. Most of your listeners think we're talking about other people. And in fact, we're talking about people you know every day. It's far more common than we think. And there's kind of a hierarchy or a series of behaviors that occur in people that are abused as children or go through a lot of hardship as children. And it has to do with being locked in fear and living in fear your whole life. And our brains and our bodies engage that mode of living very differently than it does what we'll call a normal mode of living, a fully developed mode of living. And there are a lot of ways to characterize it, things like rapid heartbeat and ability to breathe and being terrified and so forth. But what it really means long-term, I think, is the ability to live outside yourself. In other words, that we get locked in our kind of infantile brains when our brains don't develop as a result of abuse and don't develop empathy. And don't develop that ability to see the world from somebody else's perspective. And that's the social glue. That's not unimportant. That is what allows humans to be humans, the fact that we're able to get along with each other. And it's that inability to get along with each other that is generally threatening to everything we do as humans.
Well, and particularly today, we're all witnessing the consequences of this abuse and greed and violence playing out in real time at Standing Rock and also continuing to play out in Flint, Michigan as we speak today. And we're recording this the day before Thanksgiving in 2016.
Yeah, it's you can see really pronounced examples in places like Flint. That's a good place, or any Indian reservation, because of poverty in both of those places. I happen to have been born in Flint, Michigan, and so it's really interesting the contrast of what it was when I was born there 60 years ago and what it is today. And then the attention was really on children in Flint in the 1950s. They had an education system that was second to none. It was absolutely exemplary. It was the best thing, and people still talk about it to this day, how great it was, because people really believed that the future rested on children, and you had to take care of them and educate them. And today, that's completely gone. They poison their children with lead, and they don't do it deliberately. It just happened because of poverty. And as a result, the kids just really don't have a future. And when those kids don't have a future, none of the rest of us does either. You can't compartmentalize this problem and say that, because this is society. These are the people you're going to deal with on the street every day. And you can say, well, I can avoid a place like Flint, Michigan, but when 30, 40% of your population is just in this situation, and that number is, by the way, not an exaggeration, we do have that many people who are in this situation, then the society begins to lose its glue, its ability to function, its ability to go ahead with a shared destiny.
Well, and there's another dimension to what you're saying, and that is that there are people in positions of decision-making and responsibility who have lost their integrity, and their water is muddy and confused, and they've got ice in their hearts with the decisions they make.
Yeah, and interestingly, I think a lot about this in terms of the current politics in the United States. And so you can say, well, maybe that's the problem with the leadership, is that they themselves are unable to get past this kind of history. They have defects in their own brains as a result of this upbringing. And that's one possible answer. The other answer is that people who live in fear are very easy to manipulate. And all you have to do is lock them into fear mode, and you can really pretty much do what you need to do with them. and because they will react in very predictable ways. And the right wing in the United States has figured this out. And they figured out that all you're going to do is do these scare tactics all the time, and you can make people reliable followers of people like Donald Trump. And it's not new. I mean, it was done back, and we've been doing it now for 30, 40 years, that right-wing advertising and so forth is built in fear all the time. And it's interesting that we can now map the support for Donald Trump, for instance, with right-wing areas, not only that, but red areas where there's some poverty and people have a history of abuse, but also health problems. So we can, and the Washington Post did this, a very good story, that looked at the people, white people who die early tend to vote for Donald Trump. That's really interesting because white people who were abused also tend to die early.
Well, when we're flooded with manufactured fear and abused and intentionally confused, something else happens, and that is we never develop the internal strength and judgment and balance to speak our truth in the presence of a bully.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's one of the most interesting factors in all of this, is that fear mode really shuts down the prefrontal cortex, the reasoning part of your brain. It turns logic off. And so we're lacking logic. We're lacking rationality, that ability to deal calmly with any sort of threat and reason things out and come up with a solution. As a society, we've lost all rationality in some ways. It's almost like we've gone into collective panic mode, and that's made us deeply irrational and suspect of people who are rational and suspect of people who are educated. And that combination of factors is incredibly corrosive, and it's going to undermine a lot of what we're able to do.
Well, and I think it also stunts internal potential. It stunts the ability to figure out who you are and develop those strengths that allow you then to step into life and experiment and make mistakes and say, ooh, I don't like the way that turned out. I'm not going to say that quite so harshly to the next person.
Yeah.
And I'm going to begin to soften it because I realize that we all work together and we're in it together.
Yeah, and a really good way to verify what you just said is to look at the intergenerational component. One of the things that's really interesting in childhood trauma is that you can predict a trauma response in a child by looking at the mother's history. And so if mother had a trauma history, it's very good chance that that child will have a trauma response, even if that kid wasn't raised in an abusive situation. And what that tells us is that people who were abused, when they raise kids, they pass it on. They pass it on in some way that's not really definable and not intentional at all. And what that says is if we have a society that lives constantly in fear, we are going to raise fearful children. And so this thing is self-perpetuating almost as if it were genetic. And in fact, it kind of is. So there's been some really good results or some research on this. Says it is epigenetic. And so as a result of somebody's life, they pass on a trait, not through the genes, but through expression of the genes. And that's becoming vitally important is how we understand this.
Bruce Lipton makes the very important point that we have a range of genetic potential.
Yeah.
And so if we're living in fear, and the mother is stressed during the pregnancy, the child is going to be toward the life-protecting spectrum of the autonomic nervous system. And life-sustaining choices and behaviors and quiet and peace and clarity aren't going to be part of what gets pumped in terms of the endocrine system into the nourishment of that child. And they will be geared for the morphology, physically, the body structure of living in an aggressive, hostile environment.
Yeah, and that's been absolutely demonstrated. And so in science, especially in popular understanding of science, we've got way too carried away with genes as destiny. In other words, here's my genetic makeup. This is who I'm going to be. What those genes really do is set out our potential for what you're going to be. But it's your upbringing, your nurturing, it's important. In a nature-nurture argument, nurture is absolutely vital important, and not just to the individual, to the succeeding generations as well. And we've lost track of that. We've lost track of understanding how vitally important it is to raise children properly in our society.
Well, and from my point of view as an elder, it's a full-time job to learn how to use my potential. And I wasn't abused and stunted in the way we were talking about, but I sure made a lot of mistakes, and so I'm getting better at what I do and how I live.
Yeah, and that's a lifetime job.
Full-time, lifetime.
Forever to understand that. And I'm finally coming to believe that we take our humanity for granted. We think that just because we are homo sapiens, that each individual possesses what makes you a human. And I don't think that's true. I think humanity is something to be achieved, and that it takes a lifetime of nurturing and self-education and effort to really perfect those things that make us human.
There's another dimension to this, that to the phases that a population and a human life and a nation go through, so that we're probably entering a very tough time coming up that could be challenging and may actually manifest as a crisis.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's absolutely true. And I would like to think otherwise, and I'm constantly looking for ways out of this. Can we circumvent this in some way? I don't think we can. I think that we're in for a large crash. And those things, I read a lot of history, and those things aren't unprecedented at all. That we can look at things like China during the Cultural Revolution, certainly Nazi Germany, the United States during the Indian Wars, and slavery. I mean, their societies do become dysfunctional, and they're capable of incredibly cruel and oppressive acts when they do it. And it's not outside the norm at all that we're going to be that way.
And there is a rhythm to history.
If we
study it. And there, during certain times, remembering traditional values and how to cooperate is key. And my Indigenous friend up in Canada, Woody, I once asked him about a situation where the high school kids here locally didn't see any hope for the future. And he said to me, "This is not the first time humanity's faced a calamity. It's happened many times before." And the history that was passed to him was that the people who survived were the ones who knew how to cooperate.
Yeah. Yeah, that's our greatest strength. It always has been. And the successful societies and successful subcultures are the people who get along with each other and learn to capitalize and work with each other's strength in some way or another. And when we all think we're the Lone Ranger and we can go it alone, and people are very wealthy because of their intelligence or all those things, then we're missing a point. And we need to be a cooperative society. All societies are.
This is William Evans. I'm speaking with Richard Manning. This is KDNK. Well, there are some classic virtues that go with that cooperation. The people who come together in a challenging time, a long winter, and survive, traits like trust and reliability and patience and perseverance and thrift, they come alive again in a crisis, and they persist in humanity because once every full turning, once every full cycle, they're really reaffirmed and reward those who embrace them and penalize the people who forget and tend to lead toward abuse and taking what's not theirs and what they haven't earned.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's controversial in biology right now, people who deal with evolutionary biology, but nonetheless, I think what you're talking about is group selection. In other words, in the evolutionary process, the traits of certain groups are important, and one of those is cooperation, that ability to get along. So evolution will punish groups that don't get along. You can't survive. And so they get weeded out, and the cooperative groups succeed. And so they do survive over time. And it's all geared to child rearing in an interesting way. And so when we think about this, we think of all sorts of standout features or important features that make us human as opposed to other species. And one of the, and we'll talk things like opposable thumb and big brain and the fact we're good runners and all that stuff figures into this. But one of the things we never talk about but is vitally important is our children. And they are unique among all animals in being altricial, incredibly altricial. What that means is they mature very slowly. So our brains are so big that you cannot be born with a fully developed brain. It won't fit through the birth canal. And it takes 20 years for that brain to physically develop to its capacity. There's no other species like that. And because of the helplessness of our young, then it depends on groups to raise them. You must come together cooperatively and raise those kids. And the anthropologist who have studied this says, on an average, in all societies, it takes about 5 adults to raise one child. And that cooperation among those 5 adults. So if we don't cooperate, we don't go on. We don't continue as a species because our young are too dependent on our ability to raise them successfully, cooperatively.
Yeah, and the other dimension of it that is so vital is the playing in nature, because the root of a lot of violence is what you've said before, exposure to abuse in a home or a community. But kids who play together figure out how to get along, and that unstructured play is the glue that holds them together as a population as they mature into adulthood and then to becoming elders.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's really part of their education. And so we can accept information as education. We can say, well, if you go out in nature, you're going to learn what berries to eat and that sort of thing. And that information is vital, and humans happen to have a great deal more of it than most other species. But the other thing that's going on is exactly what you talk about, that engagement, that practice engagement that occurs throughout those 20 years of development that eventually brings you to a point where you're outside of your own brain and you can understand other individuals in your group. You have the empathy to get along and with other people and survive.
Yeah, when I can witness and feel the consequences of my words, positive or negative, I tune them with more care and gentleness.
Yeah. Yeah, and you learn modulation. You learn how to get along with people. Part of that skill is modulation. And where I saw this in a really interesting way, and I wrote a book called Go Wild, which talks about our ancestral health and our evolution as humans. And we have this ability not just with humans, but all species. In some ways, we have the ability to communicate and modulate with other species. And there was a wonderful example I encountered of how hunter-gatherers dealt with a lion. And when a lion showed up in the community, and it was a real threat. I mean, lions can eat their kids. They can eat them.
Right.
When the lion showed up, they didn't panic. They learned how to speak to that lion, and they literally spoke to the lion in a really calm, almost sing-songy voice that was... That kind of reflected their confidence and their ability to understand, and the lion understood it and went away. And it's that kind of lesson that we're not getting, the fact that we need to stay calm and deal with the situation in ways that control that other animal in some ways, but control it into going away, which is what they did.
Well, and the other part I would say about that story, which is an incredible story, is that the person who spoke to that lion knew totally who they were.
Yeah.
And spoke with their own authority and with a strength and a kindness that acknowledged the lion as part of creation and something that they were connected with.
Yeah, absolutely. And it works too.
Yes.
And they were actually communicating. I had a friend who died recently who is a career-long grizzly bear biologist. And in the early going, and I spent a lot of time in wilderness in Montana, he said, when you encounter a bear, you talk to it.
Yes.
And you talk to it, and you say what you mean. It's, hello, bear, I'm not going to cause you any problem. I'm not here to cause any. He said, the bear doesn't understand those words, but it understands the sentiment behind those words. Now, I've actually done this. You know, I have confronted grizzly bears. I have done exactly what that guy told me to do, and the bear went away. And so, yeah, you can talk about this in theory all you want, but until you've tested it looking straight in the eyes of an actual grizzly bear in the wilderness, you don't believe it as thoroughly as you might.
There's a level of appreciation that can only be experienced.
Yes, yes.
So
as recently as 3 months ago.
No, really?
Yes.
So was this a Craighead you were mentored?
No, I know the Craigheads, oddly enough, but this was a guy named Chuck Jonkel.
Okay. Before we close, I want to touch on a whole other area we haven't spoken about, and that is economic values. Are you familiar with Schumacher and Small is Beautiful?
Yeah. Yeah.
Well,
I'm a child of the 60s. You got to be familiar with that.
Good. Well, he makes the very important point that economics deals with a virtually limitless variety of goods and services produced and consumed by an equally limitless variety of people.
Yeah.
But it's impossible to develop an economic theory unless you're prepared to disregard a vast array of qualitative distinctions. And it's obvious that the suppression of the qualitative makes theorizing easy, but at the same time, it makes it totally sterile. And so economics is a procedure by which the higher is reduced to the level of the lower, and the priceless is given a price. And it can therefore never serve to clarify a situation and lead to an enlightened decision. All it can lead to is self-deception and the deception of others.
Yeah. Yeah. I have an economist friend who says an economist is somebody who knows the price of everything and the value of nothing.
Yeah.
And that's actually a quote of John Kennedy. But and I saw that in Flint, Michigan. And it's a wonderful example of that, is that the city fell apart. It was designed on that economic model, that if we generate income and we build enough cars, everybody's going to be fine. In fact, it didn't turn out that way. So now they're redesigning the city with GM gone. General Motors is pulled out. There is no economic driver, but there are people living there. And so they're trying to make decisions based on what the people need as opposed to what the corporation needs. And it starts driving a very different process than initially built that city. And so I think of Flint, and most people think of it as a basket case or something we need to turn our backs on, and I think of it as a place we need to watch very closely, because those places that have absent that economic thinking will evolve a life that is tenable and good for the humans there. And so I went to a farmer's market in Flint that was as nice as any as I've ever seen, and people were having a good time and enjoying it and buying high-quality food, because it's what they wanted, as opposed to what the economy wanted.
Today, right now, in addition to Flint, we've got the people of Standing Rock who know the value of water and are making their own choices and standing tall in a very difficult, uncomfortable situation.
Yeah, absolutely. And I investigated that situation some years ago when the Bakken was that's the oil field there. The Bakken was first going in. And what they're really responding to is an incredibly harsh conditions that emerged over the last 10 or 15 years there that destroyed all quality of life in that place. It destroyed their environment. So, for instance, North Dakota had a wonderful antelope, pronghorn antelope herd, living on the prairie. There are zero antelope in North Dakota today as a result of what went on there.
Wow, I didn't realize that. They're all gone.
All gone. They simply trashed the environment. And as a result of that, conditions have become incredibly harsh in North Dakota. And those communities have failed to function as communities. They're now camps for workers who drill oil, and then they go away and the oil gets pumped out. And so what you're seeing, the reaction there at Standing Rock especially, is an understanding that deeper implications of what are going on. It's not just about that pipeline. It's about destruction of an environment and a way of life and a sense of community throughout North Dakota.
Well, and it's an example of seeing people who still remember how to trust themselves and speak their truth and accommodate that expression to the culture that they've been assimilated by. And we all, as we begin to recognize who we are, can also recognize people who are not telling the truth to us.
Yeah, and we clarify our values, and once we do that, then that lack of values on then the greater economic system becomes really egregious to us, and we're willing to protest it and resist what's going on. And that word resist, I think, is going to become increasingly important to all of us over the next several years.
Yes. Thank you, Richard.
Thank you.
This is KDNK. This is William Evans. I've been speaking with Richard Manning about children, health, water, and resilience. Thank you for listening.